Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the January 6th Thursday reading of the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler. Today, we will be reading the following main articles. Denver, Schools Aim to Stay in Person by Jessica Seaman. Trucker Sentence, Judge Scolds Polis Over Commutation by Shelley Bradbury. Marshall Fire, Human Remains Discovered During Search by Kiernan Nicholson. Capital Breach, We Were Trapped, Trauma of January 6th Lingers for Lawmakers by Mary Claire Jelonek, and following up with miscellaneous articles. Denver, Schools Aim to Stay in Person, but staff shortages caused by COVID-19 have already been creating disruptions. By Jessica Seaman, The Denver Post. School districts in the Denver area stressed Wednesday that they are committed to keeping children in class despite the rapid rise of the Omicron variant, but they are preparing for the surge to exacerbate staffing shortages and potentially disrupt their plans to keep their buildings open. The shortages, which have plagued schools since the 2021-22 school year began, are worse than they were in the fall, as more employees are becoming sick with COVID-19 or other illnesses, according to district and teachers' union officials. We are definitely making preparations for January to be a very challenging month in terms of staffing shortages, said Abby Smith, spokeswoman for Cherry Creek School District. The district sent a letter to parents on Sunday warning that it could face staffing shortages that cause disruptions, such as bus routes or schools' ability to provide hot lunches. A similar message was sent to parents of students at Adams 12 five-star schools, which said it's possible schools or grade levels may move temporarily to virtual learning because of the rise in COVID-19 cases. Mike Ramirez, Deputy Superintendent of Denver Public Schools, said the district is working very hard to keep our schools open for in-person learning. The administrative offices for DPS are still working in person, but the district has limited in-person meetings to keep numbers small and is offering an option for people to attend remotely, Ramirez said. However, as of Wednesday, DPS, which returned from winter break on Tuesday, had 16 schools that already have a class, grade level, or entire building operating remotely temporarily. Four of those schools will return to in-person classes Thursday, but an additional 7 schools will either partially or entirely move to virtual learning as well, according to spokesman Scott Pribble. We all support keeping schools open, said Bob Gould, president of the Denver Classroom Teachers Association. But there's also this piece where we need more help to do that. He said he was told the district delivered KN95 masks to schools for staff members and students on Wednesday. He also heard staff shortages were so bad at one DPS school this week that 3 classes were sent to the auditorium to watch a movie. I don't know if we are really being as open and honest about how bad it is, Gould said of the district. Most of the shortages are being caused by employees and students becoming sick with COVID-19 or another illness, according to the district representatives. There were 275 Colorado schools with coronavirus outbreaks as of Wednesday, which is down from early December, when there were 320 active outbreaks. However, the data is delayed. Smith with Cherry Creek Schools said employees also are struggling to find COVID-19 tests. Schools have struggled with a substitute teacher shortage for most of the school year, and subs remain hesitant to be coming into buildings right now because they fear getting sick, said Amy Baca-Olert, president of the Colorado Education Association. We're day one or day two in most districts of back to in-person learning, and what we are seeing immediately is that there are significant numbers of staff and students who are out right now, she said. It doesn't take long for schools not to have enough people to keep schools open. Trucker sentence. Judge scolds Polis over commutation, by Shelley Bradbury, The Denver Post. The judge who presided over the trial of truck driver Rogel Aguilera Medeiros on Tuesday took Governor Jared Polis to task for the way in which he reduced the man's 110-year prison sentence to just 10 years. District Judge Bruce Jones wrote in an order obtained by the Denver Post on Wednesday that he learned of the commutation through news reports. Aguilera Medeiros had been set for a resentencing hearing in mid-January, in which Jones was expected to reduce the truck driver's 110-year prison sentence. But the governor's unusually speedy commutation upended the process. The court respects the authority of the governor to do so, Jones wrote of the sentence reduction. Based on the timing of the decision, however, it appears this respect was not mutual. Aguilera Medeiros was convicted of more than two dozen crimes after he lost his brakes in Colorado's high country in 2019 and drove his semi-trailer into stop traffic under an overpass in Lakewood, killing four people. At sentencing last month, Jones was compelled by the state's mandatory minimum sentencing laws to send Aguilera Medeiros to prison for 110 years. The lengthy sentence, twice that received by some Colorado murderers, provoked widespread outrage. More than 5 million people signed an online petition asking Polis to commute the sentence. Amid the backlash, First Judicial District Attorney Alexis King requested a resentencing hearing for Aguilera Medeiros, an unusual move given her office pursued the charges that ensured he would spend decades in prison if convicted. She said at the time she would seek a 20 to 30 year sentence for Aguilera Medeiros and later called Polis's commutation premature. That resentencing hearing was set for January 13th. But Jones canceled it in Tuesday's order. Dwayne Bailey, whose brother William died in the crash, said Wednesday that family members of the victims met with Polis before the commutation and asked him not to intervene. We thought the governor should stay out of it, Bailey said. We thought the governor was too impatient. He only had to wait 2 weeks. He should have let the process play out. While Bailey thought 110 years was too long a prison sentence, he and other family members supported a 20 to 30 year prison sentence for Aguilera Medeiros, Bailey said. In a letter announcing the commutation, Polis wrote that he was reducing the trucker's sentence to 10 years because a longer prison term was not an appropriate punishment for Aguilera Medeiros' actions. Polis wrote that he did not want to wait. There is an urgency to remedy this unjust sentence and restore confidence in the uniformity and fairness of our criminal justice system. And consequently, I have chosen to commute your sentence now, the letter read. Bailey said the governor caved to political pressure. We think, he said, he short-circuited the process of the judicial system that he said he was trying to restore faith in. Marshall Fire. Human Remains Discovered During Search, by Kiernan Nicholson, The Denver Post. Investigators searching for two people missing in last week's devastating Marshall Fire found partial human remains in unincorporated Boulder County on Wednesday. The discovery of the adult remains came as searchers worked in the 5900 block of Marshall Road, according to the Boulder County Sheriff's Office. The coroner's office will identify the remains and determine the cause and manner of the person's death. The sheriff's and coroner's offices continued to work at the scene Wednesday evening. Authorities have not publicly identified the two people still missing since the wind-blasted wildfire burned across 6,219 acres of unincorporated Boulder County, Superior, and Louisville on December 30th, destroying nearly 1,000 homes and businesses. Officials only have said they were looking for a woman living in Superior and a man in unincorporated Boulder County, and that both of their homes were destroyed by the fire. On Wednesday, in announcing the discovery of the remains, sheriff's officials said their missing person investigation in the 1500 block of South 76th Street in Superior remained ongoing. Further details were not released. The woman missing in Superior has been identified publicly by friends and relatives as Nadine Turnbull, 91. Hutch Armstrong told Nine News that family members were unable to help her out of her original town home during the fire. "They tried to go out the front door with the neighbor," he said. "It was engulfed. Checked the back door. It was engulfed." A GoFundMe campaign has been created to benefit Layla Cornell, Turnbull's granddaughter. The two women lived together in the home that was destroyed by a fire. "It's just a bit overwhelming right now," Amy Smith, a family friend who organized a fundraising effort, told the Denver Post. "It's been really, really hard. We're just doing what we can to help them." Authorities have told family members that the Superior property was searched with dogs, but they hadn't confirmed any human remains as of Wednesday, Smith said. Two horses have been confirmed dead, while two goats and two dogs are still considered missing. The sheriff's office said it had no update Wednesday on the continuing investigation into the cause and origin of the Marshall Fire. Investigators have said they have narrowed the point of origin to a neighborhood off Colorado 93 and Marshall Road, near where a passerby captured video of a burning shed on property occupied by members of the 12 Tribes, a Christian religious sect that operates the Yellow Deli in Boulder. Sheriff's officials have confirmed the 12 Tribes property, which has since been fenced off by law enforcement, is a focus of the investigation. "Wintry weather has hampered the investigations," the sheriff's office said, "and more snow began falling in the area Wednesday afternoon as temperatures dropped into the teens." Capital breach. "We were trapped. Trauma of January 6th lingers for lawmakers," by Mary Claire Jelonek, the Associated Press, Byline, Washington. Long after most other lawmakers had been rushed to safety, they were on the hard marble floor, ducking for cover. Trapped in the gallery of the House, occupying balcony seats off limits to the public because of COVID-19, approximately three dozen House Democrats were the last ones to leave the chamber January 6th, bearing witness as the certification of a presidential election gave way to a violent insurrection. As danger neared, and as the rioters were trying to break down the doors, they called their families. They scrambled for makeshift weapons and mentally prepared themselves to fight. Many thought they might die. "When I looked up, I had this realization that we were trapped," said Representative Jason Crow, Democrat of Colorado, a former Army Ranger who served three tours of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan. "They had evacuated the House floor first, and they forgot about us. Bound together by circumstance, sharing a trauma uniquely their own, the lawmakers were both the witnesses and the victims of an unprecedented assault on American democracy. Along with a small number of staffers and members of the media, they remained in the chamber as Capitol Police strained to hold back the surging, shouting mobs of supporters of then-President Donald Trump. The lawmakers finally were taken to safety about an hour after the siege began. Interviewed by the Associated Press before this week's anniversary of the attack, 10 of the House members who were in the gallery talked of being deeply shaken by their experience, recalling viscerally the sights and sounds amid the chaos. Vividly, they remembered the loud, hornet-like buzz of their gas masks, the explosive crack of tear gas in the hallways outside, the screams of officers telling them to stay down, the thunderous beating on the doors below, glass shattering as the rioters punched through a window pane, the knobs rattling ominously on the locked doors just a few feet behind them, and most indelibly, the loud clap of a gunshot reverberating across the cavernous chamber. I've heard a lot of gunshots in my time, and it was very clear what that was, Crow said. I knew that things had severely escalated. The shot was fired by Officer Michael Beard and killed Ashley Babbitt, a Trump supporter from California who was trying to crawl through the broken window of a door that leads to the House chamber. The Justice Department and Capitol Police investigated the shooting and declined to file charges. While the gunshot dispersed some of the violent mob, the lawmakers ducking in the gallery believed the worst was just beginning. I think all of us, myself included, had images of a mass shooting event, said Representative Peter Welch, Democrat of Vermont, who posted video updates on Twitter as the chaos unfolded. It was terrifying in the moment. Representative Mike Quigley, Democrat of Illinois, said he could tell the gunshot had come from the back of the chamber in the speaker's lobby just outside, and not from the main doors on the opposite side, where they could see rioters trying to break through. In that moment, he realized why they couldn't leave. They were surrounded. It was in stages that you realize the severity, he said. Their terror was compounded by knowledge of what the mob was after, stopping Congress from certifying the Electoral College votes that would make Joe Biden president. Mike Pence, as is customary for the vice president, had been presiding over the House chamber, where lawmakers were gathered to hear the certified results from all 50 U.S. states and the territories. Trump had other ideas, spouting lies about election fraud that were refuted by his own Justice Department. Trump pressured Pence to reject the electors, a move that would have bucked the Constitution and thrown the House and potentially the country into chaos. Pence refused to do so. But Trump held a rally in Washington before the vote counting began, telling hundreds of supporters at the Ellipse to fight like hell. Members of the mob chanted, "Hang Mike Pence," as they forced their way into the Capitol, brutally overpowering police who stood in their way. Dozens were injured, some seriously, and four officers who were there that day later took their own lives. Representative Val Demings, Democrat of Florida, was among those sheltering in the gallery. She tried to remain calm, drawing on what she had learned as chief of the Orlando police. But she also felt powerless, lacking a gun or any of the other weapons she always had on the beat. She shuddered when police said there had been a breach of the building. "That is probably the word that I will remember about that day for the rest of my life, more than any other," Demings said. "I knew that meant that the police had somehow lost the line. And I also know, having been a former police officer, that they would have done everything in their power to hold that line to protect us." She says she told a colleague sheltering with her in the gallery, "Just remember, we're on the right side of history. If we all die today, another group will come in and certify those ballots." Congress reconvened that night, certifying Biden's election victory before sunrise. In the days after the attack, many of the lawmakers who were in the gallery started connecting on a text message chain. It quickly evolved into therapeutic group sessions and even potluck gatherings where they tried to make sense of it all. They dubbed themselves the Gallery Group, and the name stuck. The Democrats were distancing in the balcony as they waited to speak on the floor at the invitation of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Democrat of California. And those interviewed said they don't recall any Republicans sheltering alongside them. GOP Representative Kelly Armstrong of North Dakota was in the gallery at the beginning of the insurrection and recounted the ordeal to a local news outlet that evening, but he declined to be interviewed. A handful of other Republicans, including Representative Mark Wayne Mullen of Oklahoma and Troy Nels of Texas, helped police barricade the door below. Some of the Democrats who sheltered in the gallery are planning to spend time together at the Capitol this week, not only to remember their own experiences and honor those who protected them, but also to reflect on the country's narrow escape from a coup. "We were the last people in the chamber," said Representative Mikey Sherrill of New Jersey, a former Navy helicopter pilot. "I think we saw the whole thing play out in a way that is very different from anybody else on the Hill." Representative Pramila Jayapal of Washington State helped organize the first virtual session the Sunday after the insurrection. She received texts from colleagues after she spoke up on a Democratic caucus call about what the group went through. "It ended up being a three-hour Zoom," Jayapal said. "It was deeply personal. People shared a lot of things about what they were going through. There were a lot of tears. There was a lot of anger. There was a lot of, you know, just how could this be?" Many of the members went on to seek therapy. Some were diagnosed with post-traumatic stress, their struggles exacerbated by the raw tensions on Capitol Hill and an increasing number of death threats. Others said they had been more traumatized by the growing tendency among Republican lawmakers and some in the public to downplay or ignore the violence than they were by the attack itself. Lawmakers said the gallery group has been a refuge through it all. "I think it really saved my mental health," says Representative Norma Torres, Democrat of California. "It just seemed like every time somebody posted something, we were all awake, no matter what time of day or night, and we were all responding to each other. So that was really powerful." Representative Annie Custer, who sought treatment for post-traumatic stress, says the gallery group connects almost daily on the text message chain, which moved to an encrypted app after some members raised security concerns. "Sometimes it's to get a ride to a vote. Sometimes it's, who's cooking, and can you bring a bottle of wine to a dinner together? And sometimes it's talking about our treatment for trauma and how we can preserve our democracy." Custer, Democrat of New Hampshire, was one of the first to be let out of the gallery on January 6th, escaping through the doors along with three other members just before the remaining lawmakers were locked inside. When Custer's group reached the hallway, a group of rioters was rushing toward them. "We ducked into the elevator," Custer said, "and I said to this incredible policeman, I said, oh my God, what if the elevator doors open and they kill us? And I will never forget this moment." He said, "Ma'am, I am here to protect you." And he was there to protect our democracy. Capitol breach. FBI still hunting suspects and bomber, by Michael Balsamo, the Associated Press, Byline, Washington. The suspect was covered from head to toe, skulking through the dark streets of the nation's capital before methodically placing two explosives outside the offices of the Republican and Democratic National Committees. Only 17 hours later, and just before the U.S. Capitol was stormed by a sea of pro-Trump rioters, were the pipe bombs discovered. It quickly became one of the highest priority investigations for the FBI and the Justice Department. But the trail grew cold almost immediately. A year later, federal investigators are no closer to learning the person's identity. And a key question remains. Was there a connection between the pipe bombs and the riot at the Capitol? The suspect is among hundreds of people still being sought by the FBI after last January's deadly insurrection. So far, 250 people seen on video assaulting police at the Capitol still haven't been fully identified or apprehended by the FBI, and an additional 100 are being sought for other crimes tied to the riot. The investigation has been a massive undertaking for federal law enforcement officials. More than 700 people have been charged with federal crimes stemming from the January 6th attack, and arrests are still being made regularly. But for the FBI agents working on the cases, the job is far from over. Agents and investigative analysts have been poring over thousands of hours of surveillance video, going second by second in each video to try to capture images of people who attacked officers inside the Capitol. This investigation takes time because it is a lot of work, a lot of painstaking work that they look at the video kind of frame by frame, said Stephen D. Antuono, the assistant director in charge of the FBI's field office in Washington. In one case, police body camera footage captures a man using a cane with electric prods on the end, jabbing at officers and shocking them as they fight to hold back the riotous crowd trying to break through a barricaded line of officers at one of the doors of the Capitol. The crackling sound of the electricity can be heard as he prods his cane into one of the officers. The man, known only as AFO-114, using shorthand for assaulting a federal officer, is still being sought. The assaults against the police officers are extremely serious, D'Antuono said. More than 100 police officers were attacked by rioters on January 6th, some attacked by multiple people, and some attacked multiple times, he said. In another video, a man is seen repeatedly bashing a police officer over the head with a 6-foot metal pole as he tries to push his way into the Capitol. And a third shows a man spraying some kind of chemical from a can into the faces of other officers. There is still a lot of work to be done on this, D'Antuono said. There were a lot of people up there at the Capitol, a lot of people that either committed violence up there, did other unlawful actions up there. In the search for the person who left the pipe bombs at the RNC and DNC offices, investigators have interviewed more than 900 people, collected 39,000 video files, and examined more than 400 leads. They have dived into the components of the explosives and have been working to try to discern anything they can about the suspect, from analyzing the person's gait to trying to collect information about purchases of the distinctive Nike sneakers the person wore. But they are still no closer to finding the suspect's identity and are hoping renewed attention on the video of the person may spark a tip to crack the case. Tough year for Republicans who voted to impeach following riot, by Jonathan Weissman and Luke Broadwater, The New York Times Company, Byline, Washington. The 10 House Republicans who voted to impeach Donald Trump did so with the same conviction that a president of their party deserved to be charged with inciting insurrection January 6, 2021, and the same hope that his role in doing so would finally persuade the GOP to repudiate him. But in the years since the deadliest attack on the Capitol in centuries, none of the 10 lawmakers has been able to avoid the consequences of a fundamental miscalculation about the direction of their party. The former president is very much the leader of the Republicans, and it is those who stood against him whom the party has thrust into the role of pariah. Since they cast their impeachment votes January 13th, Representatives Anthony Gonzalez of Ohio and Adam Kinzinger of Illinois have announced their retirements amid death threats from voters and hostility from colleagues. Representative Liz Cheney of Wyoming has gone from a star in the House Republican leadership to an exiled party gadfly and truth teller. Representatives Jamie Herrera Butler of Washington, Peter Major of Michigan, and Fred Upton of Michigan have Trump-endorsed primary challengers on their heels and uncertain political futures. Four others, John Katko of New York, Dan Newhouse of Washington, Tom Rice of South Carolina, and David Villadio of California, have gone to ground, silent, if not silenced, in the apparent hope that the entire episode will be forgotten. The fate of the 10 over the past year has offered a bracing reality check about the nature of today's Republican Party, one that has fully embraced the lie of a stolen election and its main purveyor, and sidelined the few remaining members who have dared to question Trump or his actions publicly. There's been this waiting game and an arbitrage between the individual's political future and the trajectory of that guy, assuming the apex has passed, Majer said in a lengthy interview referring to Trump. The view among some was that this would be essentially a self-correcting issue and that Trump's power would fade. I think that's proven overly optimistic, Mazur added. The 10 could be forgiven for believing that their votes last January would not leave them so exposed. In the immediate aftermath of the Capitol riot, some of Trump's most stalwart allies quit the government in disgust. Representative Kevin McCarthy of California, the House Republican leader, voted against impeachment but declared, "The president bears responsibility for Wednesday's attack on Congress by mob rioters." The Senate Republican leader, Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, orchestrated Trump's acquittal after a hasty Senate impeachment trial. But he had let it be known that he considered the president culpable and said as much in a scathing speech afterward. "There's no question, none, that President Trump is practically and morally responsible for provoking the events of the day. But the rhetorical cover fire proved as ephemeral as it was useless. Gonzalez, deluged with threats and fearing for the safety of his wife and children, announced in September that he would not seek re-election and called Trump a cancer for the country. Kinzinger, who announced his retirement in October, has turned his opposition to Trump into a capstone of his career, defying Republican leaders to join the House committee investigating the January 6th attack, laying into Trump and his defenders at every opportunity, and promising not to leave the political stage once his House career ends this year. Ukraine, European security. U.S., Germany say Russia poses challenge to stability. By Matthew Lee and Frank Jordans, The Associated Press, Byline, Washington. The United States and Germany said Wednesday that Russia's military buildup near Ukraine's border poses an immediate and urgent challenge to European security and that any intervention will draw severe consequences. But the country's top diplomats left open what those consequences would be and how differences on arming Ukraine and a controversial Russian gas pipeline will be resolved. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and German Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock sought to present a unified front on Russia after a meeting in Washington. Both Germany and the United States see Russia's actions toward Ukraine as an immediate and urgent challenge to peace and stability in Europe, Blinken said. "We condemn Russia's military buildup on Ukraine's borders, as well as Russia's increasingly harsh rhetoric as it continues to push the false narrative that Ukraine seeks to provoke Russia," he said. "That's a little bit like the fox saying it had no choice but to attack the hen house because somehow the hens presented a threat." Baerbock agreed. "We jointly reiterated that Russian actions and activities come with a clear price tag, and a renewed violation of Ukrainian sovereignty by Russia would have severe consequences," she said. The Blinken-Baerbock meeting followed a telephone call last week between President Joe Biden and Russian President Vladimir Putin. A conversation Sunday between Biden and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and a group discussion Tuesday among Biden's national security advisor Jake Sullivan and his counterparts from the five Nordic nations. It also preceded a flurry of meetings involving NATO foreign ministers, senior U.S. and Russian officials, the NATO-Russia Council, and the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, set for next week. The real question is whether Russia is serious about diplomacy, serious about de-escalation, Blinken said. Let's see where this goes over the next weeks. Western officials have hinted at any number of economically crippling sanctions that could be imposed should Russia act. Those include near total cutoff from the international financial system and steps toward greater NATO integration with non-allied European nations. But there have been very few specifics, and Blinken again declined to discuss them. "I'm not going to telegraph them publicly, but I can tell you with great confidence that a tremendous amount of work has been done already. There is very strong coordination and collaboration and very strong agreement on measures that would be taken in the event of renewed Russian aggression against Ukraine. As the Biden administration moves to build international consensus around a set of possible punitive measures, Germany is clearly the linchpin. Securing the support of Europe's biggest economy will be key to messaging and implementation of whatever is decided. COVID-19. U.S. advisors endorse Pfizer boosters for younger teens. By Lauren Neergaard and Mike Staube, The Associated Press. Influential government advisors are strongly urging teens as young as 12 get COVID-19 boosters as soon as they're eligible, a key move as the U.S. battles the Omicron surge and schools struggle with how to restart classes amid the spike. All Americans 16 and older are encouraged to get a booster, which health authorities say offers the best chance at avoiding the highly contagious Omicron variant. This week, the Food and Drug Administration authorized an extra Pfizer shot for kids 12 to 15 as well. But that wasn't the final hurdle. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention makes recommendations for vaccinations, and Wednesday its advisors voted that a booster was safe for the younger teens and should be offered to them once enough time, 5 months, has passed since their last shot. And although the CDC last month opened boosters as an option for 16 and 17-year-olds, the panel said the recommendation should be strengthened to say they should get the extra dose. The CDC's director, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, will weigh the panel's advice before making a final decision soon. Vaccines still offer strong protection against serious illness from any type of COVID-19, including the highly contagious Omicron variant, especially after a booster. But Omicron can slip past a layer of the vaccine's protection to cause breakthrough infections. Studies show a booster dose at least temporarily revs up virus-fighting antibodies to levels that offer the best chance at avoiding symptomatic infection, even from Omicron. Dr. Sarah Long of Drexel University said the extra shot was worth it, given how hugely contagious the Omicron mutant is. COVID-19 in Colorado. Hospitals prep for many scenarios. It is unclear if number of patients will top recent peak in November. By Meg Wingerter, The Denver Post. It's possible COVID-19 hospitalizations in the next few weeks could top what Colorado saw during the wave that peaked in November. But uncertainty around the Omicron variant makes it harder than usual to predict the virus's trajectory, state epidemiologist Dr. Rachel Herlihy said Wednesday. New cases and the percentage of tests coming back positive are at their highest rate since the pandemic began. The state also has had a substantial increase in hospitalizations. But it isn't as steep as a rise in cases, Herlihy said. At this point, the state and hospitals are preparing for a range of scenarios, she said. While a lower percentage of people who tested positive were hospitalized than in previous waves, capacity is tight. Denver hospitals warned Tuesday that they were nearly out of beds, and in some cases were treating patients in surge areas. Statewide, 1,308 people were hospitalized with confirmed COVID-19 as of Wednesday afternoon, a more than 30% increase since the most recent low point on Christmas. The last wave peaked November 24th, with 1,556 people in Colorado hospitals with the virus. It's not yet clear how many hospitalizations are incidental, meaning a person came in for some other reason and happened to test positive for COVID-19, Herlihy said. Even if a person isn't being treated for the virus, hospitals have to take extra precautions to avoid spreading it to staff members or other patients, she said. Individuals that are hospitalized for something else with COVID-19 are still a significant strain on the healthcare system, she said. Data from states and countries that were hit by the new Omicron variant earlier are painting a mixed picture, Herlihy said. About 30 days after Omicron became prominent in South Africa's Gauteng province, hospitalizations leveled off there. But the United Kingdom, especially London, continued to see a sharp increase in hospitalizations more than a month into their experience with Omicron, she said. So far, hospital capacity is relatively stable, with about 500 to 600 beds available any given day, said Scott Bookman, the state's COVID-19 incident commander. People hospitalized with Omicron appear to be less severely ill than those who had the Delta variant, but it's not clear how much they could strain the system, particularly if significant numbers of healthcare workers get sick, he said. Bookman urged the public to get vaccinated and get the booster shot if enough time has passed. While Omicron causes more breakthrough infections than other variants, vaccines still reduce the odds of getting infected, and especially of becoming seriously ill. It's also important to stay home if you feel sick, and to get tested, he said. We don't have a clear picture of where we are headed, but the basics of responding to this pandemic have not changed, he said. Broomfield issues mask mandate by Jake Shapiro, The Denver Post. Broomfield will implement a city and countywide indoor mask mandate starting Friday. Officials cited the Marshall Fire taking Louisville's Avista Adventist Hospital offline and the increases in COVID-19 cases in Broomfield because of the fast-spreading Omicron variant as reasons for the mandate. The mask order is set to expire on February 3rd and applies to indoor public spaces in the city and county to everyone age 2 and older. Broomfield was one of the few places in the Denver area without a broad mask mandate. Douglas County is now the only major county not requiring masks near Denver. According to a news release from Broomfield, since Omicron's detection in Colorado, Broomfield's 7-day cumulative incidence has increased from 221 cases per 100,000 on December 2nd to 835.2 cases per 100,000 on Tuesday. Public Safety Department. Mayor picks in-house candidate as next leader by Joe Rubino and Elise Schmelzer, The Denver Post. Mayor Michael Hancock's nominee to replace Denver's outgoing public safety director is a safety department official who led a new effort to ticket unhoused people living in tents in the city and previously worked in the sheriff's department's internal affairs bureau. Armando Soldate, Hancock's nominee, said he would focus on rising crime, homelessness, and drug overdoses as the city's top safety official. If the council approves Soldate's nomination, he would be tasked with leading a wing of city government that includes the city's police, fire, and sheriff's departments, as well as 911 emergency dispatch services. I recognize the immense challenges that our agencies face each and every day, he said Wednesday at a news conference. Coupled with the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic and rising crime, the issues our public safety personnel are grappling with require a collaborative, conservative effort to address. Whether you're an abolitionist or you want to get tough on crime, I invite you all to help by sharing your ideas and being a partner to our department, he said. Outgoing Director Murphy Robinson announced last month he would be stepping down as the city's executive director of public safety after being appointed in January 2020. Robinson's predecessor, Troy Riggs, also held the position for 2 years before leaving. Soldate is working as an assistant deputy in Robinson's office, where he ran the department's street enforcement team, a group of civilians given the power to issue citations for violations of municipal codes like the camping ban, trespassing, and being in a closed park. Soldate called for tangible changes that will help people experiencing homelessness find opportunities and resources. Homelessness is arguably the most visible concern facing Denver today, he said. Soldate also addressed the rise in some crimes in Denver and said that the city can't arrest its way out of the problem. More social and health resources are needed to stop crime before that happens, he said. Police are doing the best they can, he said. That's the million-dollar question. What can we do differently, Soldati said. So Dati also said he supported harm reduction efforts underway in Denver to help those who use drugs. Saldate said he could not give an opinion when asked if he supported the establishment of a supervised drug use site where people can use drugs without fear of arrest under the supervision of people who can intervene if they overdose. He said the possibility is being discussed, but said it wasn't the place of one person or department to decide. Saldate previously worked as a performance improvement manager for the Denver Department of Public Safety, according to a biography posted on the city's website. Some of Saldate's previous work with the safety department and sheriff's office brought him in contact with the city's Citizen Oversight Board, the volunteer body dedicated to addressing community concerns about policing and incarceration in Denver. Board member Julia Richmond said Saldate has reached out after being nominated, something she takes as a positive sign from a man who may hold the position for only a short time, until a new mayor is elected in Denver next year. "We've always known him to be a good collaborator and reform-minded," Richmond said. "We were pleased with his selection." Saldate appears to have the support of some city council members. "I believe that Armando is dedicated to improving how our departments of safety operate, with an eye on equity and anti-racist approaches," City Council President Stacey Gilmore said in a text message Wednesday. "His leadership during this time will enable the community and City Council to work in partnership to support what is working and to begin to change those policies that no longer provide for everyone's public safety." Saldate was also one of the safety department's representatives on the community-led Reimagine Policing and Public Safety Task Force. The group formed after massive protests in Denver in 2020, after the murder of George Floyd by a Minneapolis police officer. But Robinson pulled all safety department staffers from the discussion group last year after a disagreement. Councilwoman Candy Sidibaca is a strong opponent of Saldate's candidacy. On Wednesday, she said he was partly responsible for Robinson's decision to pull out of the task force because Saldate was feeding his boss negative information about the process. She called Saldate's response to the city's homelessness situation muddled and failed. "This is one of the worst choices the mayor could have made to replace former Director Robinson," Sidibaca said in a statement. "He has broken trust with the community and with our office at a time when we need trust and strong collaborative relationships with the safety department the most." Prior to joining the Department of Public Safety Administration, Saldate worked for the Denver Sheriff Department as an investigator and manager of the Internal Affairs Bureau, according to the city biography. Saldate worked as a detective with the Phoenix Police Department for 20 years before moving to Denver. He was also a deputized federal task force officer with the FBI's Phoenix Division. Nightclub Beta is shutting down for good. Denver cites multiple safety issues where fights were common, by Elise Schmelzer, the Denver Post. Denver officials on Wednesday permanently shut down Beta Nightclub after finding it violated laws by hiring unlicensed security guards, allowing people to drink after hours, and creating an atmosphere where fighting was common. The decision to revoke the club's licenses by the Denver Department of Excise and Licensing follows more than 4 months of deliberations as the nightclub's owner, Valentes Corleones, tried to stave off the city's attempt to close his club. City officials and police began to focus on the club after a series of shootings on its lower downtown block. Police tied at least one of the shootings to the club. Corleones, whose legal name is Hussam Kayeli, previously disputed the city's allegations and said he could not be held responsible for the actions of others. He previously said that the city was targeting him unfairly. Beta announced Sunday in a Facebook post that the nightclub would be closed until further notice. The post defends Corleones and said he was guilty of nothing. Denver police officers working undercover or off-duty in the club reported almost nightly fights and patrons wearing blatant gang insignia. One undercover officer got into the club while carrying a firearm, according to the order closing the club. Testimony from DPD Officer Glaspie indicated that fights were so frequent at the licensed premises that the nights with no fights were the exception, a licensing official wrote in the order revoking Beta's licenses. Though respondent objected to the frequency of physical fights on the licensed premises, Mr. Kayali himself testified that fights occurred at the club at least monthly. The revocation of Beta's licenses comes 4 days after the city suspended the licenses for another of Corleone's establishments, Cabin Tap House, following a New Year's Day shooting at the bar in which two people died and two others were wounded. The disruptive and illegal activities associated with the licensed establishment have created an unsafe and hazardous condition, and the continued operation of the establishment in this manner would be a danger to the public health, welfare, and safety of the community, Molly Duplichane, Deputy Director of the Licensing Department, wrote in the order suspending the bar's license. The day after the shooting, Corleone's posted an image on Facebook that said, "I'm closing Beta Nightclub. That's it. I'm done. Cabin Tap House is next door to Beta. Corleone's opened the tap house last year. The bar is closed until the city holds a hearing on its future." The order revoking Beta's license also states that Corleone's tried to bribe a Denver police officer to help his cause during the legal process. Corleone's also attempted to intimidate Denver police and firefighters by stating that he was a member of the Sicilian mafia mob La Cosa Nostra, the order states. Mr. Kayali knew of lax enforcement of club rules, knew or should have known that law violations were occurring, and that any such violations would put the respondent at risk of closure, the order states. His substantial presence at the licensed premises, taken with other facts, indicates a complete disregard for the law. Marshall Fire, President Tour Burn Area, by Joe Urbino, The Denver Post. President Joe Biden will be in Boulder County on Friday to tour the area where the Marshall Fire destroyed nearly 1,000 homes and businesses and burned more than 6,200 acres. Accompanying Governor Jared Polis and Democratic U.S. Representative Joe Neguse, Democrat of Lafayette, the president will survey the damage and discuss urgently needed federal support, according to a news release from Neguse's office. White House officials confirmed the visit Wednesday morning. Further details were not immediately provided. Biden already approved a request from Polis on Saturday to declare the fire scene a major disaster, unlocking federal relief dollars. "We cannot expect our communities to bear the burden of this disaster on their own," Neguse said in a statement Wednesday. "We must bring the full force of the federal government to bear as our communities work to rebuild and recover." The Marshall Fire started burning December 30th in a neighborhood near Colorado 93 and Marshall Road in eastern Boulder County. Driven by hurricane-force winds, it became the most destructive fire in state history in a matter of hours, destroying 991 homes and businesses in Superior, Louisville, and unincorporated areas, according to county officials. Another 127 buildings were damaged. In Superior, entire neighborhoods were consumed. Prior to last week, 2013's Black Forest Fire was the most destructive in state history when it came to property damage. It destroyed 489 homes and other buildings. The president's disaster declaration on Saturday made Boulder County residents eligible for support from the Federal Emergency Management Agency. FEMA money can be used for temporary housing costs, home repairs, and uninsured property losses, among other expenses, the agency said in a news release. Even people who are unsure of their eligibility are encouraged to apply. Registration information is available at disasterassistance.gov or by calling 800-621-3362. FEMA officials will also be working with the state and local governments to determine needs for infrastructure repairs, an agency official said Monday. Biden spoke with Polis about the fires by phone on Friday, according to a White House news release. According to the White House summary of the call, the president assured him that every effort will be made to provide immediate help to people in the impacted communities. Tax deadlines extended for victims, by Conrad Swanson, The Denver Post. Governor Jared Polis said Wednesday he will extend tax filing deadlines for victims of the Marshall Fire, which tore through Boulder County last week. State officials also are working with local and federal governments to offer a variety of short-term recovery resources, including housing assistance, unemployment insurance, mental health counseling, and more. Polis cabinet members outlined many of those resources during a news conference Wednesday morning at the state capitol. The governor urged victims to head to the Federal Emergency Management Agency's Disaster Recovery Center at 1755 South Public Road in Lafayette to learn which options are available to them. At the center, federal, state, and local officials, alongside nonprofits and insurance agents, can help victims find and pay for temporary housing, clothing, groceries, phone chargers, pet food, and more. Whatever you need, Polis said, you don't even have to know what you need when you show up. Your home doesn't have to be lost or even damaged, he added. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler.